Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Rita Louise, who is a co-author of a book we're discussing today called Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. Rita is a medical intuitive. She is the host of Just Energy Radio and founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. She has other books, which we will mention later in the show, and we're pleased to have her today. Welcome, Rita. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure being here with you.
Great. Well, this is a fascinating book. I first interviewed Paul von Voord in his book, God's Genes and Consciousness. That was probably 10 years ago when the book first came out. And that was my introduction to this concept. And I just was fascinated by it. I was fascinated by, the idea that the gods, with a little g, throughout all of the different cultures, may have been extraterrestrial and may have actually been involved in the original Adam, the formation of the original Homo sapien. And you've done a great job looking at all of the different creation myths, including those in the Bible, and putting them all together, a kind of a correlation. What made you get into this?
Well, it's really interesting. Three or four years ago when they started showing programming about 2012 and the whole disaster, one of the things they would say was, well, the Mayans say blah, 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 and then they would just make this kind of cursory comment about, well, Hindu mythology and Egyptian mythology say the same thing, and I'm kind of an avid researcher, and I really like reading those really old, dry, boring books no one else really wants to read. And so I started digging around and discovering that a lot of the information they were putting on TV was not... It was incomplete sentences, and so I started actually doing presentations on 2012, and as part of my research, I ran across a series of texts called the Vishnu Purana and read those, and one of the things that they talked about in there was this flood story, and the flood story read very similar to the story of Noah and the Ark, which really kind of got me going in a different area, and I started investigating flood myths, because I had heard that there were like 250 flood myths around the world or more, but the general belief that I had was that I have a flood in my area, I write down the story. You have a flood where you are, you write down your story, and so all of the narratives would have to be different, or there would have to be different things that they tell. And after doing this research on the flood, what I found was that you can summarize pretty much all of the flood stories around the world into one paragraph, which says, there was a pious, virtuous, or righteous man who is warned of an impending flood. He builds a boat, an ark, digs a canoe, climbs a tree, or climbs a mountain. He survives the flood with his wife, maybe his sister, his brother might be there, his father, maybe an old man, but a very small grouping of people. Sometimes there are children that are saved. Some of them, animals get in the boat or animals make it to the top of the mountain and are saved. And in a few of the stories, an animal is released, sometimes a bird, sometimes not a different animal. And that was it. And I spent a lot of time just really thinking about how is this possible. If we're finding that story coming out of Australia, which was populated 60,000 years ago, and we have it coming out of the Americas, which was populated very conservatively 12,000 years ago, it tells me that this myth was either extremely ancient and was still being told, or there was something else going on. But one of the things that we realized was that the flood story in the whole story of humanity was really late in the narrative, and we needed to go back to, quote-unquote, in the beginning. And so we decided to pursue this whole area because there was something going on, and there was something that no one was really talking about, this whole idea of these parallel myths that pervade the world.
Yeah, and your book begins with the the going through the different beginnings of Genesis, and then giving an explanation as to what we know scientifically about how the universe probably came about. I mean, not that we know everything, but we know some things that probably occurred. So you took it back to the very beginning, which was actually before even the galaxies were formed. You know, it was the creation myths began in the very beginning.
Well, you know, it's interesting in that it really is only, well, I don't want to say only biblical narratives. In Hindu culture, mm-hmm. they go back there as well. But there are very few narratives that actually go back that far. You know, but there people are just, in the Western world, you know, our viewpoint of the world, our cosmology is based on biblical text. And so to kind of open the door and get people comfortable with this idea of an alternative look at what's being said, you know, we decided that it was really important to start there. And then, and then get weirder because I have to tell you,
well,
Susan,
it was a good place to start. It really was.
But I have to tell you,
for me, it was really amazing.
We went into this book, I mean, pretty open-minded, but we weren't really sure where we were going to end up. You know, was it a ET question? Was it a question of there was an earlier race on the Earth? We didn't really know. But the more we investigated, the deeper and deeper down a certain rabbit hole we got taken. You know, and it was like, okay. Kind of
That's
surprising.
Right. Well, wherever it takes you.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bible is prominent in the first, in chapter 2, which is in the beginning, and the Hopi creation myths, and you talk about the Dogon myths. These are all creation myths that you correlate. And the thing that I found fascinating, because I've been studying a lot about dark matter and dark energy. In fact, I was sent the book from Caltech on that by some people when I discovered some things about a disease called Morgellons disease, which has a lot to do with dark energy and dark matter. But in any case, the idea that when God separated, the light from dark, that was separating, energy from dark energy, matter from dark matter. I thought that was just fascinating, you know, because most people would think that that would be day and night, you know, which is not necessarily true.
No, because, I mean, even if you read the Bible, sun, the moon, and the stars don't appear until day 4. And so how can we have day and night if with no sun? Kind of a, it's a
exactly.
physics impossibility.
Well, and nobody that I know, I mean, I've read lots of books, interviewed. We've been doing this show, Temple of Health, for 17 years, so you can imagine the number of people I've interviewed weekly. And I have a real strong interest in the subject matter in this book. So I try to get to, you know, the people writing about this. But that's the first time I've actually seen the creation myths compared and then explained according to what we know about science. And I think dark matter and dark energy is relatively recent. I mean, I went to school and studied physics, you know, probably 40 years ago, and we didn't hear about it then, you know, so it's not even 50 years old.
Well, you know, there's a lot of material that is in mythology that I think it's only in the last, you know, and I'm going to be really generous here, the last 100 years that we have enough of a technological base to start looking at what they're talking about and going, hey, there's something going on. I mean, when they would talk about, you know, the gods flying around in their flying celestial chariots, or, you know, you hear about the Vimanas. You know, before we had flight, you know, before we had aircraft, it just sounded like science fiction or some kind of made-up story. But now we realize that, technologically speaking, it's possible. And so if it's technologically possible, then we need to look at these myths from a technological and scientific point of view to see if what they're saying is congruent.
And the other thing, superstring theory is not that old. I actually interviewed Maku Kichu. I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but he's one of the founders of the superstring theory. Interviewed him a while back. And you mentioned superstring in your book as a way to explain some of the, you know, the descriptions in some of the creation myths. And that, you know, so what I'm saying is that the physics of just, you know, the last 20 years, superstring theory, you know, the further understanding after Einstein of quantum theory, and then the whole idea of dark matter and dark energy, which is really recent, and you relate it all back to these creation myths. You know what? And my question is, what else haven't we don't know about that would even explain the creation myths even better? You know, in the next 50 years, we may discover four more very important things in physics that go right back and really bring everything together. So,
there was one piece that we left out of the book.
What's that?
and you'll like this. See, I'm not a physicist, and you know, even on my show, I love physics, but I don't know. For some reason, it's like interviewing physicists. I just cannot wrap my brain around it. So I'm like, I love you guys, but I just don't even know where to go. So I'll leave them to you. but it's the whole concept of multiverses. You know, I had a whole section on multiverses, but it was where you find the concept of multiverses comes out of Hindu doctrine, which talks about Vishnu lying back on the ocean, and out of his navel, a lotus emerges, and on the end of the lotus, Brahma appears. And Brahma contains all of the things necessary for creation. But when you look at the imagery in Eastern philosophy of that scene, what you see is Brahma in this little bubble and all of these other bubbles around him. And one of the thoughts that I had was that Brahma was representing the physics of our universe, you know, because we have gravity here. We have... you know, a certain kind of chemical composition in our universe. You know, there's that balance that needs to happen for life and anything to appear. But there could be a different universe that has, is based on silicon, is based on different, you know, principles of physics. Exactly. You know, but we couldn't figure out where to piece that in. And there weren't really other cultures putting out
I had interviewed Aaron Laszlo on a couple of occasions, and he has probably the best description, for me anyway, of the multiverse. He's not a physicist in the classic tradition, but he certainly is a very interesting author and has one of the best descriptions of how to relate the multidimensional worlds and multiverses to consciousness, you know, how consciousness creates the multiverse. So that
But what I find fascinating and something that I firmly believe is that the ancients, our ancestors, you know, the gods, whoever, had a much deeper understanding of our universe, you know, not only on physical levels, but on multidimensional levels than than we have. And we are just barely starting to reconnect with what they have been saying, you know, or said thousands of years ago.
There is a book that I read that I never actually interviewed the author on. I probably should go back and do that. But at the time, I didn't really understand how to digest all the material in his book. But I may not have the title appropriate, and I can't remember the author. But it's a book that is called something like Atlantis and in the Neanderthals. Have you ever read or heard of that book?
No.
Well, I actually read it when I was going to Hawaii. I read it on the airplane, long trip from Atlanta to Hawaii. And
well,
it is an historical
TV
book.
Reading. It,
unlike Paul von Bord's book, which is, you know, got some channeled material and some mythical material in it, this is an historical reference. And it talks about the Neanderthals not being, you know, a primitive people, but having a lot of very interesting tools and a device that was like a laser that could cut through, stone, but yet and had the ability to change radioactive material into non-radioactive material. And all of these things are historical references, not, you know, not myths. And he says that there was like, I don't know how many, maybe 9 floods. But there was only one great flood, and that's the one that you talk about in your book, obviously, the one that, you know, was worldwide. And he says that during that flood, there's evidence that 7 asteroids hit the planet, and they all went into water. But it may, now he sort of says that that might have caused the flood, but I'm not sure that that's true. It may have been more Planet X, you know, causing a pole shift that did it, and the asteroids were just, you know, a second, secondary phenomena because they're behind the planet. But in any case, you know, these great floods, these great things that occur, may be cyclical, and that's, you know, that's something that's very interesting. And this is, like I said, in Atlantis and the Neanderthals, this is archaeological information, scientific information that doesn't fit anywhere else. And he put it together in a book that, and I was just amazed by it. And it does,
what's
I mean, some of the
again?
Things you're talking about, he has the evidence for. That's why I wanted to mention it to you, because you might want to look and see what he's dug up.
But what's his name again?
But you know, I don't know his name, but the book is Atlantis and the Neanderthals. It is actually in, I think it's Bear and Company is the publisher.
Okay.
Although it might be Hampton Roads. It's one of those two, because I go through those catalogs, you know, to get books that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'd refer you to that to see some of the stuff in there, because I was just like reading it and go, you know, why isn't this anywhere else? You know, it's the information he had in there was really, really very interesting, because it was a documented thing, you know, not a myth, not a information coming from, you know, a multidimensional source. It was actually stuff that could be shown through the records, the archaeological records.
Well, and you know, I really appreciate when people put that stuff out and put out the information and not necessarily their opinion.
Yeah, exactly. That's what was so amazing to me, because I didn't realize that information was there.
Existed.
You know, I mean, I interviewed the author of Forbidden Archaeology, and
Michael.
You know what they do whenever they have a belief system and something comes into it that's not fitting in that belief system, they just throw it out. And you had mentioned something in your book, and I wanted to tell you about, and I believe it was the Forbidden Archaeology material, but they found this, I think it was like a silver bowl, or it was some sort of artifact that was several million years old.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, remember in your book you said that nothing was left from these original gods that came? And I go, wait a minute, there's one thing that might have been. But they threw it out. You know, the regular archaeologists just didn't even put it in any textbook or anything, because obviously humans weren't walking the earth several million years ago. And yet this was dated then.
I don't think humans walk the earth in the exactly. form and context that
right.
we understand humanity, but I do believe that there were people
visitors
in some form,
and
you know, some kind of
just
being
visitors at that
here.
Time, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether or not it was populated, you know, but you brought an important point in your book. If they were just visiting at, you know, and just coming down, and they only had what they had on their ship, and they usually would gather it up and leave, they wouldn't leave very much. You know, there would be very little evidence, and it would be very unlikely that we would find that evidence, especially considering it's probably buried considerably. You know, it's under a lot of things right now, you know, deep in the earth or whatever. But there was that one thing that was discovered, and I wanted to tell you. I believe it was the Forbidden Archaeology, not the big book that he has, but he has another more condensed
right.
book. He didn't want to send
right.
me the real big one because it's just – but, you know, he's someone you might want to interview. And I believe
I've interviewed him like five times. And I've already he's coming on my show. Let's see, when's he coming on? Because I just put his little webpage up April 18th to talk about his new book.
There you go. Isn't it wonderful to have a radio show to gather all this information? That the only problem is trying to figure out who you heard what from. It's like
you know, and when we made that comment, you know, I mean, I realize that there are things that we have found, you know, that go back hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands of years. And then actually there was a recent story that I saw that they found some kind of gear mechanism in Russia that was mm-hmm. like 300 million years old. I mean, it was ancient. And
right.
You know, but there are all of these things. I mean, then there's Klaus Dohna's material. You know, they found these tools that – they are obviously tools. They are obviously finely manufactured and precision tools. But what's interesting mm-hmm. is that they're always found really far down or in a cave or somewhere underground. And so, you know, what we are doing is that we're doing surface archaeology. You know, we're digging into the dirt and going down 20, mm-hmm. 30 feet. But my belief is that these extraterrestrials or these earlier races weren't on the surface. No, mankind
right.
was on the surface. The giants were on the surface. And these other groups were in subterranean realms or in the mm-hmm. in the skies. And so if you're digging in the dirt, that's not where you're going to find them. I mean, like
right,
I think Michael
exactly.
talks about this, and then Frank Joseph also talks about this, where you know, miners are digging caves or digging tunnels, you know, and they will break into some chamber and there's this stuff in there. But they're not allowed to go
right.
in, and they're told to just cover it up, you know,
mm-hmm.
and seal it
because
back
up. Because it doesn't
up.
Fit in with the current theories. You know, anything that doesn't fit in is either, you know, there's a cover-up or... you know, I think there was one archaeologist who did describe that, and then he wasn't ever able to go back. I think it might have been Frank Joseph that said that. There was,
yeah, I
there
think
was something
it was.
That it was an amazing discovery, like you said, a subterranean discovery, and it was never really brought to light. And then the person died. The person who discovered it died, and they're not sure where it is now, you know.
Actually,
so I think
these
the
general
exist.
Location was in the Americas, Grand Canyon. I think it was somewhere in the Grand Canyon
was it?
That the cave entrance
yeah.
was in, but it was like somewhere, you know, at a weird elevation, you know, like from the bottom and from the top, so it was really challenging
mm-hmm.
to access. So...
So, you know, we may find things, I mean, if we ever are able to develop the technology to really explore under the oceans, which, you know, is vast areas never to be really never even seen by man. And also the subterranean, there's rumors of subterranean, you know, miles of road and all sorts of things down underneath the earth that exist that people have seen, but you know, we don't explore down there either. I mean, not traditional.
Well, you know, if you go with current stuff, you know, that's where all the government and ETs are,
mm-hmm.
and so we'll never gain access.
Reptilian, yeah. There's, I mean, I've read stuff that says the reptilians that live underground aren't, you know, extraterrestrial. They're terrestrial. You know, which brings up another point. You know, the many of the gods with a little G were serpent gods, and the question is, you know, did they, you know, were they terrestrial or extraterrestrial? And you know,
well,
for how long?
I mean,
long,
based,
you know,
on our research, the way that the storyline appears to go, and I'm not talking about
mm-hmm.
like there's the theory that says that there were the dinosaurs, and then the asteroid hit and it forced an
mm-hmm.
intelligent group of them to go underground. I'm not going with that
hypothesis. No, not animals.
right. You know, but when you look at mythology, the progenitors had this whole reptilian thing, and they were definitely extraterrestrials because mythology clearly talks about them being in
mm-hmm.
this cosmic egg, you know, or in an ark,
right.
you know, and traveling over the abyss.
Mm-hmm.
The first group that that is the children the children of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're born, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if your parents are foreigners and then you are born in the United States, you're an American, and so this first group
right.
of offspring were here, and so
mm-hmm.
they were terrestrial, you know, or they've been here for
right.
a bajillion
years. Well,
that's
years. A good explanation, right. Yeah.
They
you know, became
so
terrestrial
because
they were born here. Yeah.
You know, so I don't disagree with the idea that they were born here or, you know, they were definitely a founding race here,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they were not the ones that were in the ship.
Right, right. And speaking of that, you know, the one phrase that most people who are raised Christian have heard, if they've, you know, if they've read any of the Bible, is that the sons of God looked down upon the daughters of men and found them fair. And that was a very interesting you know, portion of our Bible that would have to be explained. You know, it's not understood how the sons of God would be able to mate with the daughters of men.
Well, I mean, you know, that whole passage and the stuff that people say about it, one makes me laugh. You know, like, how does God have sons? I thought there was just Jesus, or does Jesus have
right,
brothers and
yeah.
sisters? But I'm just being, you know, pretty sarcastic there. You know, but one of the things that many people say is that the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men were the giants, the Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
But when
right.
you look at mythology outside of biblical text, I mean, there's the Bible, you know, there's the Book of Enoch, which doesn't really
mm-hmm.
say anything, and where people get that piece of information that the Nephilim were the byproduct comes actually out of the Book of Jubilees. It's the only reference
mm-hmm.
that makes that claim. But
mm-hmm.
when you look at cultures other than that narrative line, it seems pretty clear that the giants were in existence long before mankind was created. And so when you read that first statement that says, and in those days the Nephilim walked the earth, and in the days after, it's a true statement. You know, and
mm-hmm.
it seems pretty clear where in this other part of it where the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men, it says they were the men of renown. You know, they were the Geborim,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, through mythology, we have stories of demigods, you know, of half men,
mm-hmm.
half God.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we found, and of course, you know, you find all this stuff, you write a book, you put it out, and then you start finding all this other stuff. So we're already talking about
mm-hmm.
revised and expanded edition because I just keep finding stuff. There is a story that comes out of the Ramayana, and so the Ramayana is a Hindu classic, and it talks about Rama, who is a avatar of Vishnu. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on, but basically Rama's wife gets kidnapped by the demon god of Lanka, and he spends a big part of the book trying to get her back. And so at one point in time, he hooks up with this group called the Vanar. Anyway, and when you read this, you just think that they're titles, but, you know, going through that literature, it is so deep. And you have to, like, take every title and, you know, he was from the line of blah, blah, and do this genealogical thing. I mean, it's really bizarre. But the Vanar are a group of they are half god, half ape. So they're ape men, all right, quote unquote, ape men. And in the book, what it says, I mean, I thought this was fascinating and validates the biblical narrative, is that Vishnu, the head god, knew that Rama was going to need help in defeating the demon god Lanka. So when Rama was born, he had the other gods come down to Earth and mate with the apes and bears on the planet to create this race of demigods. And this race of demigods had culture. They also had the skills and abilities of their parent. I mean, maybe not as intense, but their skills and ability. So if the father, like Hanuman, who is one of the major characters and is revered as a god, his father was the god of wind, the chief god of wind. And so he was described as being fleet of foot and could make these giant leaps and could travel at very high speeds because his father was the god of wind. Another couple of these ape men, their father was the god of architecture. And so at one point in time, Rama needs to build a way to get from the mainland to the island of Lanka. And so these guys construct a bridge that go across from one area to the other. And it's interesting because they believe they've actually found this bridge connecting mainland India to Sri Lanka, which interesting. But what I find fascinating is that we have basically a similar storyline of these gods mating with humanity. Now, whether they're mating, whether they're genetically producing, you know, we don't know. But
yeah, that's true. That's fascinating. Have you ever looked at anything in the Quran and related back to the Bible and the Hindu creation myths?
Not really. I mean, I believe that,
I'd like to send you something that I read recently. Actually, I read it a long time ago. I was so fascinated by it, I asked the author to send me a copy. It was actually it's not a book, it's a series of articles. And it's just absolutely fascinating. There is way more information in the Quran than in the Bible about this the stuff we're talking about today.
Really?
It says in the Quran that the asteroid belt is made of water. And actually it is. It's frozen ice. And we just discovered that a little bit ago, you know, scientifically. But that was back in the Quran.
Interesting.
So, anyway, I'll send it to you. It's a series of articles. It's fascinating, and he does the same thing, but with the Bible and the Quran, though, that you're doing in your book. But he doesn't go into all the other religions.
Well, I mean, my general belief, and maybe you're breaking up this belief for me, was that the Quran is a later text, and it's just kind of a derivation and reinterpretation of biblical text. But maybe That's not a true statement.
Nope.
Which is why I never
really
looked at it.
When you read this article, you'll find that that's just not true. The Bible has less information than the Quran. In terms of, and you know, things like the asteroid belt being made of water, you know, that's pretty, you know, that's a pretty specific statement, and yet we didn't know until just recently that that was true. So, I guess Gabriel gave that to Muhammad, right? That was a revelation text, yeah. So, makes you wonder who Gabriel really was, you know? and then here you mentioned Michael and his relationship to Lucifer, throwing Lucifer out of heaven. And I just love putting together all of that with, you know, everything with, the Zachariah Sitchin stuff, which is, you know, a whole nother thing, and trying to put everything together into one story, which is what you've done in your book.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And do we believe that we have all of the answers, you know? One of my biggest concerns is timeline. I mean, we put out what we think is the timeline, you know, but there are a lot of individuals that say that this extraterrestrial group came 100,000 years ago or, you know, 40,000 years ago, and that, to me, is not a true statement. I mean, it seems pretty clear it's not a true statement. I mean, especially even the 100,000, you know, it sounds like 100,000 years ago is a long time. But when you start looking at things like, you know, in mythology, they talk about the gods gave us fire, you know, and that is a concept that it goes around the world, and it's always a trickster god that gives us fire, you know, and so like in Norse text, it's Loki, the trickster god, and, you know, it's always the same guy. You know, we believe when they talk about these different gods, they're talking about the same guy. You know, we're not talking about 20 different trickster gods. It's one.
No, just one.
And but the interesting part is, you know, people are like, well, you know, 100,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, you know, if the gods gave us fire, I kind of think, and I'm being a little sarcastic here, that we had fire before 100,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so if you just take that one step further, I mean, because that was really what helped to dictate some of our timeline. It's like, when did we have these things? When was this possible for us? You know, and we were able to control, maybe not make, but control fire at minimally 1.5 million years ago.
Right.
If not more.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say it was about 1.5 billion years ago. That's when the archaeological evidence shows that we probably had that.
You know, I mean, one of the things that we find is that there is a convergence of a number of different traits and characteristics that point us to modern man or us as a group, you know, and that really is with Homo erectus. You know, we were obviously walking upright. We lost our hair. We were using advanced tools. We were starting to live in more cultural groups. We were starting to live in little structures, little tents and huts, you know, not just in caves. We started wearing clothes. You know, and so all of these things point more to a cultural person, you know, which is different from someone that, you know, something that's more in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, just hunting and not really having a place where they stay permanently.
You know, but if we think of, you know, apes and chimpanzees, I mean, we still put them in that animal kingdom, you know, and there is just something different about humanity. And by the time we hit Homo erectus, that shift, you know, that shift in consciousness, you know, whatever that very intangible piece is, has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, plus we have the power to speak, which they didn't have before. Miraculously, boom. In like a million years, boom.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of evidence I took a course in college on this, and I don't think it's changed since then, but basically, you know, they talked about the missing link. We do not have a clear lineage from, you know, the apes into the humanoids. I mean, there is the missing link. They've never found that yet. And so that has, you know, fueled the theories that at least part of the modern human genetic material did not come from, you know, this planet. You know, it was genetically engineered or whatever at a time when you know, maybe these gods with a little G needed some help. You know, needed some help to mine gold mines or to, you know, to help them build their whatever their structures they were building, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be the missing link there, possibly.
You know, joke around. It's not missing. It just doesn't exist.
Exactly. It's not missing. It never was. Yeah. There's something entirely different that would explain it. And you know, and I think you're absolutely right. That, you know, I studied Norse mythology intently when I was in high school. You know, I read the Upanishads and studied Hinduism, and even though there's cultural flavorings attributed to the gods, which, you know, in the northern mythology it's very different because it's so cold, you know, versus in India where it's very hot. So there's differences, but then the main story is the same. And that's what you point out in your book. It's almost like they flavor the gods based on their own culture, but especially the creation stories follow the same line of storyline.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we ended up coming out of this whole project with a belief in is that the stories that we have of the gods, you know, of their wars and intrigues and mm-hmm. vying for power and all this stuff, were not, you know, the belief now is that we wrote these stories about the gods, you know, and we
right.
made them up, you know,
we made
true,
them up,
not
right.
true, whatever. But we ended up coming out of this whole thing with the idea that these stories aren't our stories about the gods, but they are the gods' mm-hmm. stories about themselves that they taught mankind.
Mm-hmm.
Just like they taught us
right.
to use fire, just like they taught us to do agriculture and all of these different
mm-hmm.
things, they told us their stories. I mean, why would we, if we fear and revere God and worship God and pray to God for rain and good crops, write such
mm-hmm.
awful things?
Exactly. That's a good
because
point.
Because these gods were anything but kind and loving.
No.
They're more like a mafia
and
group.
And if we're genetically descended from them, that might explain some of our behavior. You know?
Well, I like to use the phrase, you know, like, do what I say, not what I do. You know, they gave us laws to
right.
follow, you know, so this is what I
yeah,
say, but
yeah.
we are definitely doing more of what they did.
Right.
Which
right.
was not
that's
good.
True. Which is not good. That's right. Well, you know, we are possibly, and you know, there's a lot of hope that this is coming to fruition. I think the reason that there's such an interest in this topic about the role of extraterrestrial or terrestrial god lineages is that I think we're going to be given a lot more information about this, either through, you know, new discoveries or through new communications, whatever. But I think we're preparing the people on Earth to receive this new information that will be coming in as part of this new age that's coming in. And because we have to know where we came from. I mean, if you don't understand your history, how can you go forward in consciousness? You know, I mean, you have to know what, you know, what really happened, I think. I think that that's very important because you don't know yourself if you don't know your history. So, you know, years ago there were like maybe one or two books on this topic, and now there are there are, you know, you probably watched the read the Chariots of the Gods when you were younger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was probably one of the first books, or Fingerprints of the Gods. But now there's a lot of information, and like what you did in your book, they're doing in other books, and that's that they're relating it back to, you know, to physics, relating it back to archaeology, relating it back to, you know, the scientific discoveries, most of which have actually been not in mainstream science. You know, they've been left out of mainstream science, but they're discoveries nonetheless. You know, you gotta,
mm-hmm.
And that's what's so exciting, is putting it all together. You know, the proof that is called like a stepchild. You know, the stepchild proof, which is left out of everything. And it's like a big puzzle.
You made the comment about all of this stuff coming out at this time, and this just kind of went through my head, and I'm like, hey, that's kind of a interesting little parallel. You know, I think it's interesting that there, and this sounds kind of terrible, but that there are all these issues happening now in the Catholic Church. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and in the Western world, I mean, it is biblical texts that keep people trapped into not being open to a different viewpoint of who we are.
Right.
I mean, if it's one God, God can't have a little g. It's
mm-hmm.
not congruent.
Right.
You know, and wouldn't you just love, I mean, you know, if you had the universal reading translator so you could read all of that material,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't you just love to get into the Vatican archive and get into some of that really old documentation that maybe
mm-hmm.
didn't burn in the Library of Alexandria?
Yeah, well, you know,
more.
Yeah. If you've interviewed Greg Braden, you probably know about the Angel Scroll. You know, the scroll found in the Dead Sea, a 1,000-word document bought by Byzantine monks in 1954, translated. The first 100 words have been translated, and it's all about reincarnation. But they think it was written by Jesus. I remember when I was in Methodist Bible school asking the teacher, why is nothing Jesus wrote in the Bible? You know, of course, there's no answer for that. but, you know, the answer is because they didn't want to put what he wrote in. You know, like it wasn't going to fit in with what the Catholic Church wanted to teach. So, you know, so, but these things are coming forth, and scholars like Greg Braden are not discovering them, but making them more widely known, that these texts exist, and who knows what's, you know, in the basement of the Vatican, probably a lot of things that need to come forth, and maybe they will, you know, maybe this is the, when the power grip loosens, maybe, you know, maybe scholars can bring this forth to the rest of the planet. But, you know, the desire for power and control has to loosen, because it just does.
Mm-hmm.
So we can be hopeful.
Well, I have my fingers crossed.
I bet you do. Well,
I mean,
we're
not necessarily about the church
end.
Falling apart, but, you know, about
yeah
the truth coming out. You know,
yeah.
it just makes
me laugh.
Well,
I think the power structure of the church has to come apart before maybe not the church itself, but the power structure has to come apart before the truth is going to be let out. I mean, they won't even let out the Fatima stories. You know, as you say in your book, you talk a little bit about that in the book, which I really appreciate. You know, what were the predictions at Fatima? You know, that still hasn't been released, and it was supposed to be released a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's problems. Anyway, we're coming up to the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information for our listeners?
Sure. And so, Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, you can purchase it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. It is available in a Kindle version. Or you can
mm-hmm.
go to my primary website, which is www.soulhealer.com. That's SOULHEALER.com. It's kind of the portal to everything Rita Louise, my books, articles. You can access the radio show there, all kinds of good stuff. And can I make one quick announcement also?
Sure. Yeah, we've got time. No problem.
Okay, great. So in June of this year, and if your listeners watch the Ancient Alien show, myself and Brian Forrester, who is very involved with the elongated skulls in Peru, and just he lives in Peru,
mm-hmm.
he's a Peru guy, He and I are organizing a tour to Peru. It's June 1st through 12th. And one of the things we're doing is we're going down there and going to be doing a bunch of remote viewing work and inviting
Great.
People to participate in a scientific inquiry using remote viewing techniques to see if we can identify who the builders were, who the gods were, when were they built, you know, and looking at it from a much more energetic, I mean, scientific but energetic, you know, and we're going to bring mm-hmm. in scientific principles to, you know, do this remote viewing work. I think it's going to be really cool. We're going to Sacsayhuaman, which is the place with the giant stones that are kind of fit together like a puzzle, and you can't figure out, one, mm-hmm. how they carved them, and two, how they got them in place.
We're
obviously going to go to Machu Picchu, and one of my personal favorite things that we're going to do is we're going to get to interact with some of the elongated skulls. I was told that we'll actually get to touch them and feel them and hold them, and so, you know, we're going to work on doing some communicating with them, as well as going into like a 2,000-year-old graveyard where the biggest and weirdest of the elongated skulls have been found,
mm-hmm.
and we're
going to
do some
Great.
Work there as well. So it's really exciting. And so
that
if you go
exciting.
To the soulhealer.com webpage, there's a big banner across the top, and you can just click through that, and it will take you to the page with
mm-hmm.
all the information about the trip, soulhealer.com.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to mention you have other books probably on your website, Dark Angels, An Insider's Guide to Ghosts, Spirits, and Attached Entities, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4 and the Power Within. And I wanted to mention that if you want to be interviewed on any of those books, just simply get them to us and we'll get you back on the show.
Okay. That sounds good. Yay.
Great. Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Rita. It's been a great discussion, and hope to have you back soon. And I want to encourage everybody to go to her website and check out this trip that she has. It sounds fascinating. Especially the remote viewing part, that'll be great. Next week, we have PMH Atwater back to talk about Children of the Fifth World, A Guide to the Coming Changes in Human Consciousness. And then Dr. Amit Goswami is back with God is Not Dead, What Quantum Physics Tells Us About Our Origins and How We Should Live. That's on the 9th of March. And then Dr. William Rea, who is a cardiovascular surgeon, world's expert in electromagnetic and multiple chemical sensitivity, will be on the 16th talking about silicone implant sensitivity. And then Jennifer Howard on the 23rd, Your Ultimate Life Plan. And then next, Noetic Science, which is the third Thursday in March, Tricia McKinnon will be talking about galactic alignment. We did a radio show with her not too long ago. Of course, she's in Atlanta and would be doing Noetic Science then at the Dunwoody office. Well, thanks a lot, Rita, for joining us, and enjoyed your book, and hope everybody reads it and has a fascinating correlation between all of the religious texts and maybe what really went on.
Well, thanks for having me, Susan, and you have a great rest of your weekend.
You too. This is Dr. Susan Cobb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.